The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Christopher Jones. The appellant, Mr. Jones, is represented by Mr. Jason Rumsa and Ms. Rachel Rasmussen, and I understand, Mr. Rumsa, you'll be presenting this morning.
Yes.
All right. And the state is represented by Ms. Ann Meyer, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. The court would like to welcome the students from West Boyd High School. With that, Mr. Rumsa, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Please, the court, counsel. The facts of this case are thoroughly laid out in the briefs that this court has before them. I will get into the facts in more detail when necessary or upon request. But the facts from all the witnesses, including the alleged victim and the defendant in this case, are fairly consistent throughout the evening, throughout the bar scene and the after bar party. This is a case where the state has alleged that the alleged victim was so intoxicated that legally she could not consent. The defendant was tried and convicted under South Dakota Rape by Intoxication Statute, which is 22-221 sub 4. And that statute reads in pertinent part, rape is an act of sexual penetration accomplished with any person under any of the following circumstances. Sub 4, if the victim is incapable of giving consent because of any intoxicating, narcotic, or anesthetic agent or hypnosis. Now, some of the facts that are most relevant to that specific question were that the state's own fact witness, the one sober person who was awoken at the after bar scene when the couples were in the hot tub, he was sober when he went to bed. And he woke to the noise and ended up joining the party and ended up joining the defendant and the alleged victim in the kitchen area. And he spent about the last hour and a half of that evening with them, talking with them, conversing with them, and generally just having a good time. He observed and testified that the alleged victim didn't seem wasted. She didn't seem drunk or anything like that. And I think his exact words were, the alleged victim didn't seem wasted or drunk or anything like that. She wasn't out of the ordinary. Now, the defendant testified the exact same thing. He didn't see her as being over the top intoxicated. Now, the state chemist, Roger Matheson, testified that because of her previous narcotic and alcohol abuse history, she was able to function at a higher level than most people with higher levels of alcohol in her system. The alleged victim herself boasted that she could hold her alcohol. Now, when it came down to instructing the jury on this, the trial court proposed an instruction, and it is in the brief there, but the defendant had one objection to that instruction. The defendant objected to it because it did not require or have the element of knowledge. The defendant maintained that the instruction should include the language that the defendant had knowledge or had reason to know that the alleged victim was at this level of intoxication where she legally could not consent. The trial judge overruled the defendant's requested instruction and went on to reason that the defendant's proposed instruction goes to what the defendant knew or subjectively thought. And that wasn't how he viewed the legislature had written up that statute. He thought that got into more of a specific intent analysis, and that was not the proper instruction to be given.
Aren't we bound, though, by what the language that's used by the legislature? How do we get around that?
I believe it's this court's duty to correctly state what the law is. The instruction would not be erroneous, or the error is if the instruction does not correctly state what the law is. And I think on the face of the law, yeah, knowledge is not listed as one of the elements, but I believe it's implied. And the reason I believe it's implied is because when you take a look at the previous statutes that we've had on the rape by intoxication, that two things were required. Well, one thing was required. It was required that it would be administered by the accused. The intoxicating agent must be administered by the accused. That presumed two things. One was responsibility, and the other was knowledge.
But the legislature specifically took out that language. Wouldn't that be an indication that they intended to eliminate the mens rea or the specific intent?
I do not believe it was, and I believe our interpretation is consistent with what the surrounding states had. And I want to get to that. The legislature amended the statute in 1985. They amended it after the Galati case, and that's State versus Galati, 365 Northwest 2nd, 575, and that's the 1985 case. The court in that case correctly interpreted the statute to require a showing that the accused or the defendant be the actual person who administered the intoxicating agent. It gave that person the defense that, hey, I didn't administer the drinks, or I didn't slip the pill, therefore you cannot find me guilty. That's how the prior language read. But what that implied was two things. Responsibility for the intoxication, but it presumed knowledge.
How do we see that in the statute? Well, you say it presumed knowledge, but where in the statute does it say that?
If somebody is responsible for administering this intoxicating agent to a victim, they have that knowledge that they are doing this.
But the legislature took that out. I mean, we're dealing with a statute where it doesn't matter. That section is not there. Now we just have a section where it says anyone, if someone's hypnotized by and they have sex with a person, the next morning they can wake up and say, you know, I was hypnotized. I didn't consent.
I think what the rape by intoxication statute's intent is to punish those who go out and take advantage of victims who are so intoxicated that they can no longer function in any appreciable manner. It protects those victims, but it also goes to punish those who have that specific intent to take advantage of this person.
Isn't that whole issue of... I mean, it gets so tied to the evidence that is disputed on whether or not she was too intoxicated. I mean, it's almost the flip side of the coin. I mean, if you have enough evidence, if the evidence doesn't show that she was too intoxicated to consent, then obviously your client or the state wasn't able to prove it. It seems like that's very closely tied to the observant. The person observing, and if it doesn't look like they're too intoxicated, and the state can't prove they were too intoxicated, how is that different with knowledge by the defendant? I mean, it seems very close as far as the evidence that's presented.
It is close, but we believe that an element, the intent of the statute is to prosecute those who take advantage, meaning an element is their knowledge, their specific intent for their own sexual gratification to take advantage of this person. The jury never reached the question of whether or not she actually consented or not. They weren't allowed to. What they had to determine was whether or not, legally, she could form the mental decisions to consent to sex. That was the question that they were presented with.
Doesn't your question or your position put a premium on irresponsibility of the accused? I mean, a normal sober person walks in the room, sees somebody in this condition, says, well, she clearly can't consent. But in this case, your client had also been drinking. Does that provide him an additional defense of saying, well, I was so drunk I thought that she consented, but, you know, it's kind of foggy for me? Does it put a premium on irresponsibility of the defendant?
I don't think it does. And in this case, though, you have the one sober fact witness that was awoken during the night and spent the last hour and a half.
Okay, well, then the follow-up question is, what standard do we use? Do we use the standard of a sober, normally intelligent person to make this decision, whether she consents or not? Or do we take the defendant as intoxicated worst?
I think the standard you use is really the same that is laid out and was laid out in the jury instruction that was given to the jury, with the exception that the defendant must have knowledge. Now, the jury instruction that was given to the jury was quite encompassing. It explained that as it pertained to the victim's intoxication rendered her unable to exercise reasonable judgment in the process of forming mental or intellectual decisions and of discerning or comparing all the circumstances present at the time. It is not enough that the victim is intoxicated to some degree or that intoxication reduces the victim's sexual inhibitions. In order to establish that the level of the victim's intoxication deprives the victim of the legal capacity to consent to the act.
So are you asking that there be added another element, that the state would then have to prove that the defendant subjectively knew this? Is that what you're asking? Or I think Justice's question was, is this a subjective of what he knew or what an objective person, the reasonable man, would know? What standard are you asking for?
I believe the standard would be that whether the defendant knew or had reason to know that this person was so intoxicated that she could not legally consent. It's going to be the same story. Without the subjective element, it's going to be, was she so intoxicated that legally we say she cannot consent, because really she cannot function in any appreciable manner. That's going to be the same standard, but we're also asking that the court require it to be an element that the defendant has knowledge of this. And I believe that was the original intent of the law. And I think that interpretation is consistent with that of North Dakota, of Minnesota, of Iowa, of Nebraska. All of their statutes with the rape by intoxication require the defendant know or has reason to know that this person is so intoxicated that legally they cannot consent.
Don't those statutes actually harm your argument? Because very clearly those states have put that requirement in their statute. Ours, it doesn't have that.
And I believe the way our statute became what it is was reactionary, because the prior statute required administration by the accused. There was no reason to protect this person from this charge because they did not physically administer the intoxicating agent. It gave that a defense, and there was no reason. There was no logical reason to give this person a defense. The other statutes in the other states don't necessarily require that the accused be the one who actually administers the intoxicating agent. They require, though, that he has knowledge or should have reason to know of her level of intoxication.
But, you know, the legislature repealed the requirement of administering the agent. And so it seems to me that you're asking us to adopt a rule of statutory construction that when the legislature does that, they unintentionally removed the knowledge requirement. Isn't that what you're asking us to assume? The legislature made a mistake, accidentally did something?
I believe they intended well. I believe they intended to take out the requirement that this person be responsible for that. But when they did that, they took out the knowledge requirement. And I think that's always been...
And you're saying that they didn't mean to do that. They took it out, but they didn't mean to. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying, isn't it?
In a way, but the prior statute, which required administration, required both responsibility and knowledge was presumed there. So they took out the words that required the administration. They took out those words, and it made sense to do so, because why protect this person who comes in and takes advantage of this victim because he or she did not administer the intoxicating agent? That made no sense. So they took out the plain language that said they must administer the agent. I think when they did that, though, what they took out, which was once implied with that language, was knowledge. The prior statute required more than just knowledge. It required responsibility. And so when they took out the language that required responsibility, they took out what was presumed with that, which was knowledge.
Do you have any authority to, I mean, I know you've cited a lot of state cases, state legislatures, but do you have any legal authority that are binding on us that says that the concept of mens rea is to be read into a statute like this because of the nature of the crime?
the authority I have is really nothing that this court is bound by, but which this court has looked to the reasoning of other courts in Iowa, in North Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota. This court has looked to their reasoning in the past and said, yes, that makes sense. You know, with respect to these specific statutes, all of those other states that I've cited, yes, this court is not bound, but the reasoning is the same as I argue. And in the case of State versus Schuster, this court found the rationale from Iowa and from Washington courts. And State versus Schuster is 502 Northwest 2nd 565, and it was a 1993 case. So they found that, and that was a case dealing with a mentally handicapped victim, and they found that akin to rape of a minor, where we as a society place such high value on protecting our minors from those who may engage in sexual acts with them. We protect those people. There's a higher standard. It's not a defense in those cases that I did not know she was too young. That's not a defense. We place a higher standard in those sorts of cases. And we also do in South Dakota with the mentally handicapped. We say, hey, if you are engaging in a sexual act with somebody who's mentally handicapped, who has the mindset of an 8-year-old, you act at your own peril. We place that category of victims at a higher level. I'm not saying that we don't protect those under subsection 4. We do. What we're asking is that the knowledge requirement, which is once presumed, be a required element that the state must show, because I believe it's designed to punish those who take advantage. Meaning, this person has the intent or knowledge that this person cannot legally form the decision or go through the decision-making process to engage in a sexual act. At least subsection 4 is designed to punish those people. And it's a different class of persons that we're trying to protect under subsection 4.
But that you're asking the court to interpret it that way, but there's nothing to prevent the legislature from saying and making a policy that they want to protect those people as much as they do underage children or girls and boys, and also mentally handicapped. I mean, what's to prevent the legislature from protecting that class of people in the same fashion?
Under subsection 4?
Right. And how could we, if the plain language indicates they do, how can we go against that and say, no, that's a different class of protected victim and requires a different element of knowledge?
Because I think that the legislature, when the statute was originally drafted and when it was originally written, the intent was to punish those who take advantage. And I think when they removed the administration requirement, which made no sense, there was no reason to have to give a defense to somebody because they didn't administer the intoxicating agent. I think they intended well when they did that, but what they also took out, which was once presumed under the prior statute, was knowledge. They are offered protection under subsection 4. We're just asking that it not be that same level of protection that we give to our minors. These are the people that we're trying to protect under this subsection are those who go out and voluntarily consume alcohol or do drugs to the point where...
2 minutes.
To the point where they can no longer function in any appreciable manner. It's a different class of persons to begin with. You know, with a mentally handicapped or the minors, that's a status. They have no control over that, the fact that they're too young or that they are mentally handicapped. They cannot control those. We offer them heightened protection. Subsection 4, though, these classes of persons are able to consent to sexual acts until they become so intoxicated that they cannot go through the mental process of engaging or consenting to a sexual act. Again, I think it's important to note, if we're not requiring the knowledge requirement, it really opens the door it really broadens the scope of subsection 4. In the case at hand, the alleged victim was not even the most intoxicated female at the party to engage in sex that night. It was the girl who was celebrating her 21st birthday. She had been drinking 3 hours prior to when the alleged victim began drinking. Under this interpretation, the state's interpretation of this, her boyfriend, too, would be guilty of rape by intoxication. We're saying that it should go to something more, that the defendant's knowledge or intent to take advantage should be a requirement. And the only way to do that is to read into the statute what is implied, that the defendant have this knowledge.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. If you listen to what the defense is saying today, they are asking you to decide this case on law that doesn't exist and on a determination of credibility that was made below by the jury. Everything he's saying is a legislative choice, and the believability of the witness at trial is a jury choice. And what this court does in interpreting statutes is look at the plain language of the statute. If it's clear and unambiguous, I always get stuck on that word, then your only function is to declare the meaning. There's no knowledge requirement or mens rea in subsection 4 of our rape statute. The way you have to look at that and draw the conclusion is that if the legislature wanted it in there, just like the court has pointed out, they would have put it in, and it's not there. Now, in terms of what Judge Jensen did, he used an objective test. He even says it on the record that he's not going to get into the defendant's subjective knowledge. He's not going down that route. He's fashioning a jury instruction that looks at it from the elements in the statute, which were, does the victim have the ability to consent to the sexual acts, or is she too intoxicated to do that? Has she lost her rationale and her ability to reason?
So anytime a person has sex with someone who's been drinking, they're at risk of being charged with rape if later on that person who'd been drinking said, I had too much.
Depends on the facts.
Well, I understand that, but that's always open, and it's always open to a jury deciding sometime later whether the consent was incapable of giving consent because of intoxication.
Yeah, and that's a credibility question for the jury, and you're correct. This victim had no interest in this defendant. She found that he was weird. She thought he was telling disgusting stories. She had no use for him. They were not a couple, as he suggested, Abby and her boyfriend Chance were. They didn't have a romantic relationship. He was pursuing her. She wasn't interested in him. And what they're not doing in terms of, the defense is not doing in terms of telling the story of the facts here today, is pulling this down to the minutes when the victim is on the couch. It's 3 a.m. She's out of it. She doesn't have, she is almost, to an average person like me, and she's not an average drinker, she's approaching a legal level where she's going to be dangerously intoxicated. She's approaching the level of poisonous alcohol poisoning based on what our expert said. She's at 0.43 and ranging to a 0.29% of alcohol in her blood. At 0.45 and above, our expert says, you're running into problems if you're an average drinker. Now, she has experience at doing this, but when he goes for her, and he's performing the rapes and against her will, she's not in a position to protect herself. And that's what the legislature is trying to protect. There's not all these different classes. Whether, and Justice Meyer is right, gender-specific, male or female, there's no reason why the South Dakota legislature can't protect people more in our state who can't protect themselves because of narcotics, because of alcohol, because of hypnosis. Why wouldn't we want to have that kind of policy?
Doesn't the breadth of the statute concern you, though? I mean, someone could say the day after, I was hypnotized. How would how would a person know if they were hypnotized? And the law wouldn't even require that they know. They go to the jury, and the jury says, well, you know, he didn't know that she was hypnotized, but the law doesn't require that he know. Therefore, he's guilty, even though he thought she consented. And I understand that's a far-fetched example, but the law would this law would encompass such facts.
That's why you have the weights and balances of the jury looking at this and making those credibility determinations. You know, everybody's in this together. You've got everybody doing a separate role. And the jury is the one that's going to make that determination. If there was some kind of outlandish claim like that, that's what our system is set up to test. You know, you would have the states, if the state even took that as a prosecution, you know, first and foremost, we have to prove the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So that would be the first thing.
Could and be if a directed verdict on the elements of the crime, because someone could think he's having consensual sex, or she, and then only find out later on that that person was under the influence of some kind of narcotic that they weren't able to consent. They would never know until the next day or the next month or God knows when.
No, they're going to know because the jury's going to figure that out. And also, if you look at the elements of the statute, the statute says...
The jury's going to know, but not the person who's committing not the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator.
He's entitled to put his defense on. He could say, I didn't know. So the defendant in this case...
He could say, I didn't know, and that wouldn't even be relevant.
But in this case, the court let him put his defense on and say, I didn't know that she was intoxicated. So that message got to the jury. The trial court steered down that middle street. He let us put on the jury instruction that was suggested by, I think both parties kind of worked on it, but he came up with it. And in that jury instruction, it has what you're looking at and what you're trying to avoid, which is, it says, does that victim, has she lost the capacity because of any one of those things, hypnosis or drugs or anything like that? Can she not make a reasonable, intelligent choice? And she not have the reasoning and the ability to make that choice? And those are the elements of the crime and the type of things that the jury is going to be looking at. And hopefully, if you have a case where you can't prove your case, you are going to make a motion for judgment acquittal as far as the defense, and you're going to make a motion for directed verdict. And somebody's going to listen to you, meaning the trial court. That's the person who's there, who's guiding all this, and they're going to listen to that. It's not an open-ended statute. It's the way that the facts work out. And I don't see the risk to the defendant. I see more of the risk to people who are unprotected, can't defend themselves. They're just like the people who have some kind of mental impurity, or if you are not old enough to consent, it's the same ball game.
I can see how the facts of this case, even if the jury was told that he had to know, probably the jury would have convicted him under the facts of this case as they were presented. And I can see how the statute's designed to prevent such things as the use of a rape drug and those kinds of things, whether it's administered by the perpetrator or somebody else. But I guess I'm concerned that if we look at the plain meaning of this statute, it could be abused. And I'm wondering if this is the kind of statute that we should be reading the mens rea requirement into it.
Not at all. It's not your function. In the first place, the Constitution doesn't give you that power. With all due respect to the court, that's not your role. That is a role for the legislature. Sometimes they rewrite the law according to your opinions, but you don't get to do that to them. And that's the way that, if you look at the burglary case, Miranda, that I've listed in our brief, they will do that, but you don't get to rewrite that and put that in there.
I agree you don't, but does the statute, is the statute so clear that we know that the legislature intended to take that out?
Certainly works for the state. The words are clear. That's the precise meaning of the statute. There's no ambiguity there. It's there. There's no knowledge. You can't import it. You can't add it on and graft it. You're stuck. Yeah, that's just the way it is.
I'm stuck. Let me read something to you from the United States Supreme Court. Silence on mens rea does not by itself necessarily suggest that the legislature intended to dispense with a conventional mens rea requirement. And all the treatises that we've been able to find say the existence of mens rea is the rule of, rather than the exception to,
the principles of Anglo-American criminal jurisprudence. So many courts, even though the statute itself doesn't say mens rea, in non-welfare offenses, I mean true felonies, many courts read mens rea into the statute in order to protect innocent people from the honest belief that there is consent.
That may be true, but this is not an innocent person. And we're talking about a case where I'm trying to analogize the victim who is not able to protect herself because of alcohol or drugs or hypnosis to the same kind of thing that you see with someone who is not old enough to consent or someone who doesn't have a capacity. Our court has said in State v. Schuster, and this may not be the court that you were, but in our precedent, we don't look at the defendant's knowledge. We don't look at that factor because what the important thing is what we're seeing from the victim's perspective. And I think it's a difficult thing. I don't know if the case that you're talking about is talking about sexual cases or murder cases or just in general, and I'm assuming that you mean in general. But by our rules...
Well, I'm responding to your statement that we're stuck, and the United States Supreme Court and many other courts take the position that when the legislature is silent, where they don't say... And many courts say if they're intending to take out the knowledge requirement, they have to say so explicitly. In a case like this, where you're charging a true felony, they have to say so explicitly. I'm responding to that because other courts in various different crimes say, no, we're going to read mens rea in these traditional-type felonies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But under our rules of statutory construction, it's gone. So you don't have it anymore. And if you read it in, you're going to be violating what we have in our state, in our body of law, what we've developed in terms of statutory construction principles. And certainly in this case, the defendant's intent is not the controlling factor because because we're looking at it from the victim's angle. And when he went over and went for her, I think there's just no other way you can look at it that it was purposeful. So the jury had that before them, and they're, in effect, they're trying to weigh and balance the two sides of the story. And so we get there in the end if the jury looks at this. But
your facts are compelling, but, of course, we have to look at this statute as being applied in other circumstances.
Well, and also you can't look at this case in terms of hypotheticals. This case is what it is, and that may be something that you want to address another day because we do have to look at this case for the type of situation that we have there and or what we have here. And the court was cognizant of that. I mean, Judge Jensen specifically looked at the fact that he wasn't going to get into the defendant's knowledge. You know, he weighed and balanced it. He said there's a case out there that says that, you know, I need to look at these things. And he did. But he said, I don't see it in the statute. And the state's position is that that reasoning isn't wrong in this case. Well, I may not have convinced you, but I don't want to concede my position. So it's not how... That's not how, up to this point, courts have looked at it in our state. We've looked at it through straight statutory construction. And I wanted to pick up on this fact, what the defendant said when he was talking about there being one sober witness. There are lots of witnesses at trial. The witness that he's talking about was the owner of the house. His name was Brent. He conceded on redirect examination that he didn't know the victim that well, that he thought she had a buzz, he didn't think she was drunk. But we also have just the tally of drinks. You know, the game changer in this case is the amount of alcohol that this victim has consumed. She's incredibly high level of alcohol, and she can't fight back for herself. And that's why we're looking at our expert's testimony, her testimony, what her friend Abby says. Abby says, I was belligerently drunk. The witness matched me drink for drink, shot for shot. And she's not someone who would have sexual relations with somebody that she just met. That wasn't her typical way of proceeding. If the court has any further questions,
thank you
very
Ms.
much.
Meyer. Mr. Rumsey, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The state alluded to the credibility as being a question for the jury. But again, the jury was never asked to determine whether or not the defendant or the alleged victim actually consented to the sexual act. They weren't allowed to get to that issue. The only thing that they were allowed to do was determine whether or not they believed that her level of intoxication prohibited her from legally being able to consent to the act. With regard to the motion for judgment of acquittal, the fact witness, the homeowner, is observing her as not being anything out of the ordinary. Sure, she was drinking. He knew that. Everybody knew that. But she wasn't out of the ordinary. The defendant testified to the same thing. And the state chemist had also testified that she was able to function at these higher levels than most people because of her past. The tally of drinks, we can't set a standard that has a certain blood alcohol content to determine whether or not this person was incapable of consenting or due to her level of intoxication. What blood alcohol content would be appropriate? Everybody consumes and reacts to alcohol differently. What may be the case for one person with several drinks could be the same level of intoxication for another person with 15 drinks. I mean, every person reacts differently. And so when the defense made the motion for judgment of acquittal, the reasoning was that to the own witnesses and the own witness of the owner of the home, the defendant, and the alleged victim herself testified that they were having a good time. They were conversing. How could a jury determine, or any reasonable person, that this person who's having a conversation cannot make the mental decision to engage in a sexual act? As far as the credibility goes, the jury was never asked to determine whether or not she actually consented because they couldn't get there. I believe it's the role of this court to correctly state what the law is. I believe through the prior statutes, the statutes of the surrounding states, that mens rea is implied in this statute, and that to send it to the jury without having the requirement be shown by the state that this defendant knew, that this defendant took advantage of this victim, without being able to tell the jury that the defendant, if he didn't know, then he cannot be guilty, without being able to do that, what do you have here? You have a testimony about drinks. It was conceded that sex acts did happen. So you have testimony about drinks, drink level. Well, at what point, then, are we drawing this line? We're saying that what the defense is saying is that this level of intoxication should be so obvious to the accused, and that the statute is designed to punish that person who takes advantage of somebody in that state. We're not asking that this court rewrite the statutes. We're simply asking that it correctly interpret what the intent was with this statute. And when that's done, knowledge is there. Knowledge is presumed in the statute because it's designed to punish those who take advantage of others. Again, what the state has proposed is that the defendant's knowledge should not be included in this. And I think that misses the point. We say the defendant's knowledge isn't required in the rape statutes that deal with the minors or the classes of persons that our society has deemed worthy of great protection, higher levels of protection. But to say that defendant's knowledge is not a question here, it doesn't take a great mental leap to come up with the hypotheticals where this statute, the way the state has asked us to interpret it, could lead to very absurd results. And even just don't have to look farther than the facts of this case, where you had one other female in the house who had been drinking, arguably more than the alleged victim, who engaged in a sexual act that night. it opens the door for those to come in the next morning and say, I was obviously drinking too much last night because we had sex and I would not consent to it. Normally, I would not consent, but that's not the level that we're talking about here. The jury instruction or the level of intoxication, it's not enough that they're intoxicated to some point or that their sexual inhibitions are reduced. That's not what we're talking about. It opens the door for them to come out and say, though, that I was too intoxicated, I don't remember, I know we had sex. But then you take the case and you prosecute the accused or the defendant, and if he doesn't know this, then where is he acting? Why is he convicted of a felony when he's simply engaging in a sexual act with somebody, and if he didn't know, he was doing any wrong? I think knowledge is implied in the statute. We're simply asking that this court read the knowledge into the requirement that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. For those reasons, we respectfully request this court find the trial court committed reversible error when it refused to grant the defendant's proposed instruction requiring defendant to have knowledge of the alleged victim's inability to give consent because of intoxication. Furthermore, notwithstanding the trial court's refusal of defendant's proposed instruction, the defendant respectfully requests this court find it reversible error, and the trial court refused to grant defendant's motion for judgment of acquittal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rose. Take your seat. At this point, Justice Meyer-Henry would like to read a statement.
Thank you for the personal privilege, Chief Justice, colleagues. When I started my career here at the law school, I could not have imagined I would be back 37 years later as a Supreme Court justice announcing my retirement. But that's my intention today. I have informed Chief Justice Gilbertson, my fellow justices, and Governor Dugard that I will be retiring in June of this year. A press release is being issued as I speak. When I became a judge 22 years ago, I never intended to stay this long. I, along with two of my contemporaries, Judges R.D. Hurd and Jean Paul Keane, had an elaborate plan that we would retire at the same time. We were going to rent Judge Hurd's favorite local pub, invite everyone to join us, and celebrate. Of course, that didn't happen. 15 years ago, Judge Hurd died suddenly at the age of 54. Judge Keene retired from the circuit bench at the end of his term 5 years ago. And I kept working. So much for that plan. My dad always said that life depends a lot on luck and that some people are just lucky. I consider myself one of the lucky ones. I've had the most rewarding career, more than I could have ever hoped for. I genuinely looked forward to going to work every day. I liked judging. I liked the lawyers. I liked my colleagues. I feel privileged to have been able to contribute my skills and talents to our system of justice in service to the citizens of this state. Many things have changed over the last 22 years, but one thing has not changed. That's the administration of justice. Every citizen has the right to bring his or her dispute to court, the right to receive a fair and impartial decision. Because the natural business of the courts involves conflict and distress, most people would rather not be there. And in the end, at least one of the parties will not like the outcome. Even so, the parties can remain confident that their issues will be considered fairly, that they will be treated with respect, compassion, and competence. Judges and court personnel are there every day to make sure that that happens. I'm very proud to have served with these talented, dedicated people. There does come a time, however, when retirement starts to beckon. My file of things I still want to accomplish personally and law-related is getting larger. My time is getting shorter. It is said that life and time are our only real possessions. I believe that's true. The past 22 years, I have willingly dedicated a large portion of my life and time to doing the job of judging. It's time for me to reclaim those two possessions for my own use. One final note of thanks to my family, my friends, and of course, my esteemed colleagues for all the support and the encouragement they've given me over the years. It's been a great run. Thank you.
Closing thought on behalf of the justices. We're not generally known to be emotional people, but this is an emotional time for us because we know we are going to shortly be saying goodbye to not only a colleague but a friend. Justice Meyer Henry has served for, I believe, 9 years on the South Dakota Supreme Court and many years before that as a circuit judge and a presiding circuit judge of the busiest circuit in this state. Throughout this, her conduct has been exemplary, and she has certainly led the path for those half of you law students who are females, because when she became a judge back, I believe, in 1988, there were no women judges. We had had one, but she had retired. Justice Meyer Henry, as you leave the Supreme Court, you have the satisfaction of knowing that you've left this court a better place for us justices, for the people in the system, and the citizens of the state of South Dakota. So once again, thank you for everything, and Godspeed. We are in recess.